Everyone loves a good mystery, so we'll dig into some on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Craig Hart is a writer of mysteries and thrillers, but so much more. After we chat with him, Garrison Keillor will bring us more of the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. Craig, you packed a lot into one lifetime.
I try.
Well, I mean, radio and writing and so on. How do you categorize yourself these days? People ask you, what do you do, Craig? What do you say?
Well, my go-to response is that I'm a stay-at-home dad. I have two-year-old twin boys. And so that keeps me busy during the day most of the time.
I would think so.
But I do, in my mind, I think of myself as a writer. And I've managed somehow to maintain that inner persona throughout the challenges of raising children as well.
You have quite a few books to your credit. I think the recent, I saw there's a trilogy of some kind that's out now, three books.
Yeah, it's the Shelby Alexander Thriller Series, and there are four books out now.
Four, okay.
And the fifth one is scheduled to come out at the end of November.
Okay. And how do you – is this a single person around whom you spin four different stories and maybe more to go? Is that the way that mystery writers do it now? You pick a protagonist and work him to death?
Yeah, typically, yeah. And it's funny you mention that because whenever I get into a series reading that somebody else has written, I always think, how much more can this poor guy or woman take?
Are they meant to be read in order? That is, does your character grow and change and
alter?
That's become typical too, I think.
Yes. I've tried to run it a couple different ways or so that you can do either. So one thing I wanted to do when I went from literary fiction to genre fiction, thrillers, was I wanted to take some of the aspects of literary fiction and bring it into thriller genre, which is characterization. A lot of times, not always, there are some great genre writers, and I'm not speaking against genre at all, but sometimes it's very plot-heavy and the character is forgotten. What I wanted to do is focus also on character, because once you have a good, solid character, what is happening in the book, the plot means so much more. For example, if the character is in danger, that makes no difference if nobody cares about the character, because who cares what happens to them? They don't feel like they know them. They have no stake in it. But with this series, what I've tried to do is take that same character and build their character and persona and backstory throughout the books so that the more you read in the series, the more meaningful future events have. Now, each book does contain its own storyline. It has an encapsulated plot. But I think it does mean more if you start at the beginning and work your way through with the character.
That's interesting because I was a great fan of Ross McDonald, and I thought he brought into genre fiction some of the great fiction, some of the great themes of literature. And that's quite a trick.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you structure your books? I mean, do you work out a plot? Do you do the outline first and then write the book?
Not usually. I really wish I could. And I've tried to do it multiple times because in my mind, it would be so much easier to write the book if I had a roadmap. But I haven't. My mind just doesn't seem to work that way. So what I've done is outline as I go. So I write a few chapters and I outline those. And so because I've discovered once I get to the mid to two-thirds point in a book, it's very difficult to keep all the pieces in your head at once. So if I have that existing outline of stuff I've already written, that keeps me grounded and helps me move forward.
So you're taking notes on your own writing, right?
Right, exactly. That's exactly what I'm doing. Doing a book report on my own book.
Right.
Do you get credit for it? read us a little bit from one of your books. Give us a sample. This is a Serenity book, right?
Yes, this is a Serenity. This is the first in the series. Each book has Serenity in the title. So this is Serenity. Book two is Serenity Stalked. Serenity Avenged and Serenity Submerged. So we mm-hmm. carry through in that way as well. This is from chapter one of the first book. Shelby Alexander filled his mug with coffee and inhaled the robust aroma of the dark brown liquid. It was far too late to be drinking this stuff, but he silenced the warning in his head by deciding to sleep in tomorrow morning. He wouldn't, of course. His days of sleeping in had long deserted him, the day his daughter Leslie had been born 30 years ago. After months of sleepless nights and early mornings, his body's natural clock had forever changed. Shelby wondered what Leslie was doing. Newly turned 30, she was an adult woman more than capable of caring for herself, but Shelby still thought of her as a little girl and found himself worrying she would fall into bad company or feel hungry or alone. But times had changed, and more recently he had noticed the role shifting. Now she was the one calling to inquire into his welfare. Was he eating, sleeping well, taking vitamins, exercising, keeping his medical appointments? At almost 60, Shelby considered himself in excellent health. He suffered occasionally from arthritis in his hands, a result of his years as a professional boxer, but this rarely impacted his life too dramatically as long as he remained cognizant of how much he was using his hands. His years as an athlete were also responsible for his remaining active at an age when many of his peers were beginning to feel their age. He could still lift the same weights, run the same distance, although with a frequency that was much less. He knew he was on the far side of his prime, as much as he tried not to think about it. He moved to the kitchen window and looked out at the darkness of the Michigan night as he drank his coffee. It could be incredibly dark in northern Michigan, especially in the winter with its overcast skies that blotted out the moon and stars. When he first moved back to the small town of Serenity in search of a little peace and slow living, he had marveled at the difference. The light pollution caused by the larger cities downstate seemed to prevent it from ever being truly dark. But up here, the darkness could become an almost palpable thing.
You know, you have done so many interesting things in that introduction. We've learned that he has a daughter. We've learned that he was a boxer. He was an athlete. We know now where he is. I love the way you reveal almost paragraph by paragraph,
well,
something about the character.
But it's more than information. I love the rhythm of the sentences.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't, you know, I, and I often don't hear that, but in
what,
a piece of
what
writing.
Is it the length of the sentences or the way they're...
No, it's the way he phrased, I mean, the rhythm isn't uniform. I mean, there's a rhythm to it, right? Mm-hmm. A waves. I don't know. Is that deliberate or?
It is. Partly, I'll say, because I've always been long interested in audio. I record a lot of audiobooks,
right.
And I did work for.
Well, that's right. It listens too well.
Yeah.
So I try to write. I hear it in my head as I'm writing because I'm used to audio.
Right.
And I think that probably helps because when you read things aloud, they often sound a lot different than if you were reading them on a page,
right.
Or things jump out at you more.
I'm a great believer in that writing ought to proceed like conversation. The words are written on a page, and you find some older literary forms where there's great craft in putting the sentences together, but they are sentences on a page. They don't lift into the air quite as easily.
Mm.
And I like writing that does. It moves into the ear.
Mm-hmm.
So is that because of your radio background?
It could be, and I've also, I won't cheat myself, I've spent a lot of time working on it because I've been very aware of that. I believe that reading should not be a chore for the reader. I think one sentence should pull them through to the next sentence, one page to the next, one chapter to the next. You should do the work for your reader as a writer and make it fun and easy for them, and not the other way around.
Let's go back to the beginning for a minute. How did you become a writer in the first place?
Well, I guess I first started writing when I was, maybe 10, 11 years old. We had an old word processor, and my mom began paying me $5 for every little book I would type out on there. And then I took a little detour. I decided I wanted to become a professional pianist, so I pursued that, and I did get a few gigs, but then carpal tunnel struck and ended that little dream. And so I went back to my first love of writing and have been doing that steadily for about 15 years now.
So your carpal tunnel led to a little arthritis in the hand for the boxer.
There are parts of Shelby that are me.
Are you sort of a self-taught writer, or have you done a workshop, or?
I would say mostly self-taught. I have attended some college classes at a couple different universities, but mostly it's been reading, writing, and testing my writing against what I've read, and going back and trying to fix it, and back and forth, trial and error. And I think that's a – I would certainly advise anyone to take writing courses. The one thing I will say, and the ones that I've observed, is that it is easy when you're taking a writing course, particularly if it's a high-profile course with high-powered professors. You can begin to adopt their style because they're attempting to teach you in a certain way. And I think it's important to develop your own voice as a writer.
Well, that's true with reading, too. You read Henry James, and pretty soon she went the whole, so to speak, hog. You're writing like Henry James. Stop this. Right. Stop this.
Exactly, yeah.
I would not know what a style is. You know, it's when I write, it's just I'm just trying to get some ideas down on paper, and if there's a style to it, it eludes me. But so many skillful writers are able to look at writing and see in it more than I can see, even as people can look into a painting and see more than I see.
That's a great analogy. I see
the whole thing. I don't see all the details. Mm-hmm. How long does it take you to craft a novel?
The Shelby ones move fast. Now, that's partly because of my marketing plan. But the first Serenity, I would say, took me about 6 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, I really tore through it. and each one has taken between 1 and 2 months to complete because I put myself on a very strict schedule. I've been very disciplined about it because, again, part of the marketing plan, but also because I have a lot of ideas backed up for when I was working on other things that want to get out there. And I know that this is my opportunity, and I've grown an audience, and It's been a great experience for me.
Well, tell me about this marketing plan. Sure. What is that, and where did that come from?
That started about a year ago when I had a sudden epiphany, which I realized I need to start treating writing like a business. To me, I've always been a little like, writing is an art. I'm not going to taint it with business and all that stuff. But I realized if I want to keep doing it and make money at it and perhaps one day make a decent income at it, I need to start approaching it as if that is my actual goal and not pretend it isn't. So that's what I did about a year ago, and it's worked out pretty well. I'm working on my fifth one now, and I'm to a point now where I know that I have readers waiting, and I know I'll make sales. It used to be in the past, I put it out there on Amazon or something, and it's just fingers crossed, will anybody buy it? And I'm happy to say that those days are gone because I know I have an existing audience now that I've built over the last 12, 13 months that are eagerly awaiting what I give them. And that's a great feeling to have, and it provides impetus to go forward.
So are these self-published?
Yes, they are. Mm-hmm.
Which has become pretty common today. I mean, even writers that have once had publishers go back to self-publishing simply because they have more control over.
And they also have more income. A friend of mine toward the end of her career did that. She decided, the pittance she got from her publisher, although her book seemed to sell pretty well, she was not realizing much from it. But by self-publishing, all of a sudden, she had a bigger percentage of the sale price.
Sure. And we were talking about royalties, whereas a publisher might give you 8 to 12, maybe 15% if you're really lucky. I'm getting 50% of everything I can break in. Or in some cases on Amazon, 70%, depending on the price I set.
Uh-huh.
So, 70% of less is still more than 15% of...
Right.
Oh, it just bruises my artistic soul to hear you talk in such crass commercial terms.
I know. It took me a long time. I'm still not quite over it. I'm blushing now. You can't see. It's radio, but...
I want to talk a little bit before we run out of time about the whole mystery genre. I just reading an article about how the more democratic a country is, the more it loves mysteries. Hmm. In Nazi Germany, for instance, mysteries were almost not ever read. and in dictatorships, mysteries are not popular, but it's no accident, I think, that in Britain and America especially, mysteries have always been way, way up there. Why would that be? Why should a democracy prize mysteries?
I think people are always interested in what they're not experiencing. So if you're living in a country that provides you great freedom and there's at least the facade that things are going well and whatnot, there's a part of the human, I think, nature that craves something different than what you have. It's kind of the grass is always greener kind of thing. I mean, not that we want it to be a dictatorship, but it entertains us because we're not in it. I think if we were in it, we'd be a lot more interested in, you know, happily ever after.
Right.
I think that's probably part of it, at least.
Yeah, it is interesting that the mysteries proliferate, and you find people who have no experience in writing. If they decide to write, it'll be a mystery. So you're in a somewhat crowded field.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. And you do have to make your own mark. So you feel that the Serenity series is doing it for you, that you're making headway?
I do. So I've gone over the last year. So the first Serenity has been downloaded over 150,000 times.
Wow.
And that to me would have been unheard of a year ago. I didn't even dream of that. And then other books have done not quite as well, but they're catching up as I promote them more. And I do have other ideas like spy stories and whatnot. But one thing I have tried to do in this series is make it a little bit different. For example, I've had a lot of readers write to me and say, thank you for making sure that your protagonist was not an ex-Navy SEAL with, you know, six-pack abs. And, you know, he's a real guy. He's 60. He's feeling his age. You know, he has limitations. And people have really appreciated that because that alone sets it apart from a lot of books in the pack.
Uh-huh. Well, I'd say you've made a very good start on your marketing plan. How many more Serenity books how much can a small town handle?
I don't know.
Look at Murder, She Wrote. Right? Half of Cabot Cove's been killed off already.
Well, in each book, I keep meaning to write one called Serenity and Gulf, where the whole place burns down. I'm done with the series. I'm not quite there yet. So I'd like to get 10 books in the series before I wipe it off the map.
So, Serenity, your days are numbered.
Louise Penny, the Canadian writer, does that with Three Pines, this little teeny town. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and she was going to stop with 8 books, and she just couldn't stop.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Moore series, the murder rate in Oxford went up terribly. Well, Craig, it's been a joy to talk to you and to hear about your success with the Serenity series, and we wish you further that your business plan, your marketing plan, comes to a very successful conclusion to enable you to write the great art novel of all time.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed being here.
Okay, and with that, we'll turn from our guest, Craig Hart, writer of the Serenity series, to Garrison Keillor, the man who anchors the Writer's Almanac. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information is at bloodcenter.org. Oh, my. The way Craig Hart writes mysteries, I wish I could
do
that.
We forgot to ask him how our listeners could get his book, and I'm assuming everyone knows that anything is available on Amazon, as his are. But also, he said, a couple of Barnes & Nobles stock them, and if they don't, Barnes & Nobles can order them. So if you go to Barnes & Nobles, you can order one of his Serenity series through Barnes & Nobles. And from the little that he read, it sounds worth it.
Yeah. So there are 4 books. I think one is coming out and the end of this month. But there are 4 altogether, and they're the Serenity series by Craig Hart, H-A-R-T. Well, you find anything?
I want to start by asking a question by way of introducing this book. What is so fascinating to people about balloons? And I'm thinking, you all, I don't know if you've ever been in a stadium with several thousand people, and all of a sudden someone, little kid's balloon gets going, and it starts floating upward, and it's almost, it looks like it's going to hook on the corner of the stadium. and then it breaks free, and everybody, the whole stadium says, ah. I mean, nobody pays any attention to anything except that balloon, and then they watch it disappear up into the air.
Well, it's because our thoughts are lifted upward, I guess.
Well, up is a strange direction when you stop to think about it, and I didn't realize that. Don Erickson gave me a book, and he always gives me books that just sends me 180 degrees in the from the direction I've been going. This one is about the history of ballooning.
Oh, yeah.
And it's called Falling Upward. It's by Richard Holmes, and it deals with 150 years of ballooning activity from the Mongolfiers until the Wrights take off.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea that balloons had such an interesting and intricate history. But the fascination with going upward is just amazing. I mean, there were people back in the early days of ballooning that let themselves go up to the point in altitude to where they passed out from lack of oxygen, knowing that, again, the balloon would eventually come and hopefully they'd start breathing again.
Yeah.
But just to get up, up, up.
Well, birds. I mean, birds can fly, and you have that image in front of you. Why can't I fly? I would love to do that, to be free of the bonds of gravity, to soar up and see things from above. That thought has to have been with people from the first time they marveled at animals flying in the sky.
Well, I mean, it turns out that Ben Franklin was tremendously interested in ballooning. Poe used ballooning early in his macabre stories. And during the siege of Paris, when the Germans had surrounded Paris, balloons went in and out with messages and with food. And it was used in the Civil War. People telegraphed Lincoln from up in a balloon where they could see the battle
you know,
that was closing in on Washington. There were showmen who did balloonings. There were scientific experiments. There were fairs and circuses and competitions. Margaret took me up on my 50th birthday as a birthday present in a balloon. And she didn't say, where are we going? Well, this is a surprise. So we drove out 30th Street, and all of a sudden, there in a field was a balloon being inflated.
Yeah.
And a guy came over to us on crutches and said, I'm normally the pilot, but I broke my legs in a landing last week. You're going to have a substitute pilot. But
have a good time.
Have a good time. There were my kids. I said goodbye to them maybe for the last time. And Margaret and I got in the balloon. And what Richard Holmes says is the dominant feeling that people report from being in a balloon is hilarity.
Yeah.
There is nothing like being in a balloon because you don't feel any wind. You're going with the wind. There's no noise except for the whoosh occasionally when they have to heat it up again. You can hear dogs barking. You can hear people on back porches talking. There is something really weird and strange and hilarious, I guess, about ballooning.
Yeah.
So this is a book that goes through that entire history. It's just wonderful.
Well, and who wrote it, or what's the name?
Richard Holmes. It's called Falling Upward.
Okay, and we'll fall out right now as our time is up. Thank you very much for joining us. Roll Tweet and I'll be back again next Saturday. We hope you'll be with us for the next edition of Scribble.